Welcome to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. I'm your host, Kevin S. Fox, coming to you from Studio O, just north of Philadelphia in the great Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. In tonight's episode, our 58th, we look at the poster bear, or the polar bear, as an icon for climate change communication. I set out on this two-episode exploration of the polar bear with this idea that the polar bear exists in at least two realms. One being in its biological living self, and the other, the polar bear that exists in the media. And I wanted to talk to two experts last month's episode, talking to a wildlife biologist working with polar bears over the past decade. And for the media side of things, I contacted Dorothea Born. Dorothea Born is finishing up her PhD at the Department of Science and Technology Studies, the University of Vienna. She was a visiting doctoral student at the Rachel Carson Center for Environment and Society and the Munich Center for Technology in Society. She graduated in ecology from the University of Vienna and wrote her master's thesis on climate change in the Arctic. In her PhD project, Imagining Nature in Climate Change Communication in Popular Science Magazines, she investigates conceptions of nature present in visualizations of climate change in both National Geographic and the German-based GEO. Her research interests gravitate around science communication and science journalism, environmentalism, and visual cultures, and conceptions of and relations to nature. So from Dorothea Born's Bearing Witness, Polar Bears as Icons for Climate Change Communication in National Geographic. Here's the abstract. This article investigates how polar bears were established as icons of climate change in the popular science magazine National Geographic. In a multi-step process, anthropomorphized depictions first established polar bears as subjects of identification. Then polar bears were visually connected to the endangered Arctic. Finally, they emerged as ambassadors of a threatened ecosystem and icons of climate change. Highlighting the wider political context of this process of iconization and the semiotic and cultural resources on which it draws, Born shows what kind of climate change communication the polar bear icon enables or inhibits. The icon lends itself to being deployed in visual communication strategies, creating personal concern and public awareness for climate change. At the same time, the icon fosters an individualized, emotionalized, and localized account of climate change, but does not make its wider causes visible. Joining us from her apartment in Munich is Dorothea.
So you're doing a PhD in visual climate change communication, looking specifically at popular science magazines. Let's maybe start off with a big question. How difficult is it to visualize climate change? It's kind of a hard enterprise. It's a hard project to kind of carry out. How are popular magazines representing and visualizing climate change?
I think climate change is especially difficult to visualize because the tricky thing with climate change is that we want to prevent it. So we want to prevent something that lies in the future. The thing with visualizing climate change, especially in the beginning, so I start looking at those magazines when climate change starts being an issue, which is in the 1990s, they didn't know how to visualize something that they want to prevent that lies in the future. So now, unfortunately, it's getting easier because you can really see the consequences of climate change. But then climate change is something so global and also happening over those vast time spans that it's really hard to to visualize something like that in like one shot. So, for example, one strategy that also National Geographic uses a lot is time shots, like this glacier, how it looked in the 1970s, and this glacier, how it looks now, or also of the Arctic in summer, and this is how far the ice has retreated, or something like that.
Right, and the Arctic is kind of a special place, or a place that popular magazines do show quite a bit, because you can see the difference in ice flows, right? You can see the difference in yes. the ice from year to year. It's mappable, but also through photography and video, you can see that. And is that why the Arctic is kind of a region that is being used to show climate change?
I think what applies for the Arctic also applies a bit for the polar bear.
Yeah.
It is photogenic, it yields nice shots, but it's also really a region that is more affected by climate change than other regions. So there's also something like the Arctic Climate Impact Assessment, which is similar to the IPCC, a body that of researchers that focus just on the Arctic, because it's more impacted by climate change because of positive feedback cycles. Like the ice cover goes away and then the surface is brown and absorbs the heat more. And so it warms up more quicker, or permafrost melts and then you have more earth layers that are open, and then microorganisms produce more CO2 and you have more CO2 in the atmosphere. So all those positive feedback cycles also affect the Arctic more. So as with the polar bears, who are also clearly threatened by climate change, it has like natural scientific basis, and then this is used in the media.
Yeah, so the polar bear really, and this is the major, the crux of your research, is the polar bear has emerged as almost an icon, not only for the Arctic region, but also for what climate change looks like and what could be, and maybe this is what you're getting at in your research, but what are some of the consequences of climate change? How did the polar bear get there? I'd like to make the argument that the polar bear exists at least in two sort of realms. One is it's an actual living being that lives in the Arctic, but it's also living in the media and as an icon, as a symbol. And it's circulating throughout, in households. It arrives in households through documentaries and through magazines. How did the polar bear get there?
Yeah, that was one of the questions that fascinated me also, because when I started my research, actually, it was already there. I said, I'm looking at visual climate change communication. Everyone said, oh, so you're looking at polar bears. And that was interesting for me that I often got that response.
Yeah.
Because when I started my PhD, I actually hadn't even looked at my material like that closely. But of course, what came out, or maybe not, of course, maybe it could have been different, but it wasn't. When I actually did content analysis with images in National Geographic, the polar bear was by far the most depicted animal.
Yeah, not the Arctic fox, or not the walrus, like a sea.
Or grill, seal. Arctic grill. It's very important for the food chain also.
Right, right.
It's not this charismatic megafauna that also serves as a very good projection surface for identification. So how did the polar bear get there? I think there are several things, and I'm not sure what role National Geographic played exactly, because I think National Geographic certainly, when we look at the US, is kind of representing something, but then also reproducing it. One strategic move of environmentalists was to get climate change on the agenda of the Bush administration. Mm-hmm. And for that, they kind of used the polar bear and started this campaign that the polar bear should be on the list of endangered species and included in this Endangered Species Act.
Yeah.
Because of climate change. And that was kind of forcing the Bush administration to address the agenda of climate change, because if the animal is in danger because of climate change, then they cannot deny that climate change is happening in a way. This was about 2006 when Al Gore's movie came out and also used that animated polar bear. And this is also about the time when in National Geographic the images of the polar bear bears change.
Changed, yeah.
Yeah. So what I looked at is that in the late 1990s, polar bears were very anthropomorphized, and they were also those cuddly and playful bears. And these images changed in 2005 and 2006 to the bear being shown as more vulnerable and more threatened, and these are also shots taken from further away, where the bear is more part of the Arctic landscape, part of the Arctic environment, and becomes more a symbol and less this subject in a way.
Yeah.
But this is only possible because there was this phase of anthropomorphizing bears before. And this, again, was only possible because the polar bear has a very long cultural history. Coca-Cola's use of the polar bear is one example. I had this childhood book of Lars, the little polar bear who gets lost. And it's very interesting how these polar bears are now used for climate change campaigns.
So the polar bear isn't new. The polar bear isn't new to the media then. The polar bear's been there, but maybe under a different, with a slightly different meaning. More of this teddy bear.
Exactly.
Still a symbol of the Arctic, though, probably, but a tame Arctic, a cuddly Arctic, and not a sort of end of world climate change narrative Arctic.
And yes. But it's also interesting that before it was that cuddly bear, National Geographic also had this movie, I don't know if you know it, that was filmed in the 1980s, where they were again shown as more threatening creatures.
All right.
But, and I also didn't watch it because it was out of the kind of time period that I looked at, because I wanted to look at the specific connection of polar bears and climate change. But yeah, they had a photographer inside a cage, and then they put seal oil on the cage, and the polar bear came and attacked the cage, and it's all very dramatic.
Yes.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
The polar bear stands for the Arctic, and it has been standing for the Arctic for a long time. I mean, there's a long history of trophy hunting for polar bears, for example, and this idea of conquering kind of the last frontier is very much connected to that. And all those Arctic expeditions that were carried out in the, late 1900s, beginning early 20th century.
Right. The Arctic fever, as people call it. All the expeditions to the north, eventually to find the North Pole, but also Northwest Passage. And it does fit into, you know, the narrative of maybe of empire, of being able to conquer these unknown lands and the animals that are there, much like maybe a safari to Africa or a big game hunt would have been, and still is for some people, in the savannah of Africa. In one of your papers, you mentioned the icon of the polar bear is meant as a stand-in for humanity and the drifting ice flow. And you're probably specifically mentioning this famous photo of the two polar bears on an ice floe.
Yeah.
And it's framed in such a way that you can't see much else around it and you think they're just lost to sea. Who knows? The land might be a kilometer away, but we don't know that from the photo. And so you say that the icon is meant as a stand-in for humanity, and the drifting ice flow becomes a reference to spaceship Earth.
The whole thing with the spaceship Earth is something that also that is kind of connected to another icon, right? The icon of Earth, the image of Earth taken from the universe during the Apollo mission, which became kind of this icon for environmentalism, because there was this idea, this is our planet, and it's also vulnerable and it's so beautiful, and we can see it as a whole. And I had the feeling that the drifting ice flow is kind of connected to this other icon for environmentalism, where Earth is drifting in space, and here the polar bears are drifting on the sea. And of course, you're right, it's all a question of context and how something is framed, because first of all, polar bears are very good swimmers, so it's unlikely that they will, I don't know, be lost, or they want to go back to land. They can just jump into the water and swim there.
Right.
And also, the land might actually be not far away. So it's all a question of framing and of context. And that's why I think it's also important to question the power of images and what they can do, in a sense.
Images create a certain gaze, right? I mean, because when we talk about gaze here, what do we mean? We mean they're asking us or requiring us to focus in on something. But in that focusing in on something, we lose sight of the other that is around. Just to kind of give a broad definition, maybe. Maybe you work with it a little bit differently, but... Yeah, what might you say? Because you talk about in your work that this gaze. In fact, you even say that the gaze maybe comes even from our view of the Arctic as a blank space.
Yeah, I think the concept of the gaze is important because it's also the concept of the gaze in visual theory draws our attention to power relations. You could actually draw some parallels between what we talked before, trophy hunting, going to the savannah, and taking pictures of polar bears. It's kind of connected in the sense that we're also hunting for the trophy of the picture of the polar bear, and there's a whole industry, a whole polar bear tourism going on in Churchill, Manitoba. I don't know if you know about that.
Yeah.
The concept of the gaze draws our attention to the fact that we as humans are taking these pictures of these animals and positioning them in a certain way to, for some communicative means and ends. And it kind of also in this moment takes away all agency from the animals themselves.
Yeah.
So this is also an asymmetrical power relation that's going on here. And of course, in a way, this is connected to this imagination of the Arctic as this blank sheet where we can just go and explore, and no one's living up there anyways. And
yet there's 4 million people that live there. There's 4 million people that live in what we consider the Arctic.
But yeah, with these imaginations of exploring and conquering. It's kind of connected to that. A kind of Arctic colonialism, if you want.
Right.
Call it that way.
Do you think here with the polar bear as this iconic species, what are some of the consequences of focusing so much on the polar bear? Are we, in terms of this, the concept of the gaze, are we eliminating some of the political and economic processes that are going on by focusing in on this, on the polar bear, and having the polar bear be the poster species, if you will? Does it eliminate then maybe some of the complexities? And you call them are they hiding the social and political complexities connected to the issue? And here, I guess the issue is climate change and not the survival of the polar bear necessarily.
That's something that I can also only assume to a certain degree, because I'm not doing audience reception studies. So yeah. Going about and asking, 1,000 people, and that wouldn't be enough what they think of the icon of the polar bear. So when you do image analysis, it's also that you only look at the images and then draw from there. But the icon has its good sides or positive sides in that it can draw attention and raise awareness because of what it is, because the bear is this charismatic species and has a resemblance to human beings and kind of enables identification, and you see the bear and you think, oh, it's suffering and we have to help them, so we have to do something against climate change.
Yeah.
But I think it does hide the complexities, actually the causes of climate change. I mean, who's responsible for climate change? Well, we are. But then that's also something where maybe in the US context, it's easier to show a polar bear than to show, cars or TVs or airplanes or whatever could be kind of the stand-in for the industrial Western lifestyle that we've become so adapted
to. Yeah, and comfortable with. So the visualizing of the visual communication of climate change is using a victim almost. Maybe I don't want to say victim, but is showing the consequences and not the causes. The polar bear is helping us show the consequences and the potential future, or that future is even arriving in the future scenarios of how climate change is going to affect our planet Earth. We're already seeing it in the Arctic, and the polar bear is the first, to be really affected. Instead of a visual communication that shows causes and is willing to grapple with those complexities, the social and political complexities of energy use or overconsumption of non-renewable energies, and we're not showing that
exactly, or the burning of fossil fuels and the oil industry, meat industry as well.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
But it's actually interesting that I don't think victim or victimization is that wrong, because also the ways polar bears have been used, not necessarily by National Geographic, but by other organizations, for example, is that of a victim. So, for example, Greenpeace Austria has this very drastic poster where they have a polar bear and then they poured oil over its coat. So this white, innocent fur is like covered in oil, and they say save the Arctic, and they're very much, the polar bear is a victim. And I think is also not doing the animals justice in a way. So here this idea with the gaze comes in again, that we're displaying these animals in a specific way, but that maybe doesn't have anything to do with what these animals need or want, or also with their living realities, maybe.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations, radio expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Do you have an idea for an episode or want to give some feedback? Go to the comments section on the website or to the blog and enter into the conversation. Now let's get back to our expedition. So I want to read from Dorothea Bourne's article, Communicating Science, Transforming Knowledge, Insights into the Knowledge Communication Practices of the Popular Science Magazine Geo, which is based in Germany. And so here's the abstract. Popular science magazines are an often neglected medium in the field of science communication, while being committed to the scientific community, upholding an ethos of scientific accuracy, they aim at mediating science and are thus actively selecting, transforming, and recontextualizing scientific knowledge. Constituting a hybrid space of science communication, they continuously redraw the boundaries between science and a highly educated broader public that is co-constructed through the specific communication practices of these magazines. Her paper draws on ethnographic observations at the editorial office of the German popular science magazine Geo. Tracing its production processes, she shows how editorial members conceptualize science communication and on what notions of science they base their assumptions. This is linked to how GEO's target audiences are imagined and what kind of scientific literacy is ascribed to them. By approaching these practices through the lens of science and technology studies, or STS, her article contributes to an understanding of how popular science magazines produce and communicate knowledge.
I really like this notion of knowing spaces. How does that kind of come into your work, this idea of knowing spaces? What are they?
Yeah. They're everywhere.
Right.
I mean, this idea stems from the fact that this other paper you read on National Geographic is part of an edited volume on science communication.
Yeah.
So this notion of the knowing space kind of came in also through the editing process, but it fits, I think, very well what a popular science magazine is and does. And especially when you look at different media species, so to say, or different media formats, it's a very interesting knowing space, because obviously there's this idea of news value and what has news value, and in like mainstream media, other things have news value than in popular science magazines. And then there are certain rules on how to tell a story and how you can say something in popular science magazines. And of course, it has to be based on science and scientific research and results. And that was very interesting for me also to see when I did actually some kind of ethnographic observations at the editorial offices of GEO, at the German popular science magazines that I look at.
Yeah.
Because they have like really contradicting aspirations in some sense, because they want their stories to be based on science and really be scientifically accurate, but then they cannot say it in that way because then the readers won't understand it, or maybe it won't be that interesting for readers. So popular science magazines are kind of really on the threshold between more specialized magazines and mass media, and I think that's a very interesting position to stand, and also a difficult position at some times.
So they're kind of caught in between. They want to get the science right, but yeah, they also need to reach their audience who's buying their magazines, and they know, they have data, they know who their readers are and how old they are, what other magazines they read, and so they need to continue kind of doing their narrative telling and their storytelling in such a way. Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting to go in a very Bruno Latour, go into the, right? I mean, in the sense of going to the place that you're wanting to, the ethnographic kind of work of going into, you know, for him going into a science laboratory to then really look at how the process works. And for you to go into the editorial team room and look at the process. I recognize on the Bearing Witness article that, you know, you acknowledge the National Geographic editorial staff and thank them.
Yeah.
How did you interact with them? I mean, were they very forthcoming in sharing some of their insights about why they chose certain images of polar bears over others? Or what was that interaction like?
Yes, they were all really very helpful. And I didn't have the same access at National Geographic's editorial department, just I think because it's much larger and also more restricted.
Yeah.
So I couldn't really do observations, for example, of a conference or something like that. A lot of editors I talked to were really, really helpful and gave me some insights. Yeah, it was very interesting for me to see also how also some individual people really fought for climate change being on the agenda in National Geographic, because that's, I think, where politics and science then actually mingle while they were trying to keep it apart. So one editor, even showed me some internal magazine that he created for conservation issues and that he was like handing around to other editors to make a point for climate change. On the other hand, he was like, it's not political because this is the science. But of course it's political to try to get it on the agenda.
Right.
So
they
were kind of trying to keep science and politics apart while they were obviously doing politics with science. Yeah, these interviews and insights were immensely helpful and really met some nice people who were interested in my work, and then later on helped me with copyright issues of getting images and so on, and gave me contact. So, I mean, I'm somewhat critical of what National Geographic is doing, but I think it's also really important what they're doing, especially in the US context, because I think it's really not easy. And so I think this also needs to be acknowledged. And in one of the issues, for example, where they had, I think, three large articles about climate change, and it was the first series of articles where they really said, yeah, this is anthropogenic climate change, the editor also wrote, yeah, no, maybe I will lose some subscribers, but I have to do that because this is the science and we have to get that out. And so, yeah, I can imagine that for National Geographic, who is actually trying to be really to represent this all-American gaze, the issue of climate change actually posed a really a big challenge because it so divides the American population.
Yeah. I mean, could they be, could someone say you're being political if you don't report on it? I mean, did it reach, was that part of, you think, what maybe forced them to actually do some articles in a whole magazine edition on climate change, because if they didn't, that would be seen as being political as well.
Yeah, I think it's not possible not to act in a political way. I think everything you do or don't do is in a way political. The science and especially the IPCC reports then of course helped them, because they could say this is science and this is kind of objective science and we're only reporting the facts.
Yeah, and that is the challenge of communicating, you know, back to this idea of how to communicate climate change. And they had to find strategies. And is this kind of how the polar bear then becomes the icon in some ways? Is because they already have a following of people who like to look at images of polar bears. And the polar bear then becomes, it already exists in the popular imagination of the,
yes,
the National Geographic reader. And so it's just kind of, in terms of like code switching, maybe a little bit of then what the meaning of that polar bear can be to the reader.
Yeah, exactly. And I think those images that existed before and those images that showed the bears in a very anthropomorphized way, those were very important for the polar bear then be able to become the icon, because you have to have this identification and kind of one-to-one emotional connection before you can put it on an ice floe that is farther away and say, those two polar bears that are actually not that big on that image, they are endangered, but you like them because you saw them before in kind of closer up.
You're listening to Geographical Imaginations. Geographical Imaginations is a growing multimedia public geography initiative designed to bring academic and everyday geographical thinking together. We believe everybody is a geographer and a co-maker of spaces. As an inquiry-based project, we ask questions and explore themes through dialogues with different texts and voices. Inevitably, our explorations return to simple yet complex questions, like how does blank inform the way I picture the world in my head? And how does that picture in turn limit or expand my place in the world? The main focus of the project is this hour-long radio essay program, or radio essay expedition, that's broadcast monthly from Radio Fabrique in Salzburg, Austria. In each episode, we make brief expeditions into the geographies of everything and nothing. We reflect upon our relationships with the worlds we inhabit and co-create. While many of the episodes deal with local and regional topics, themes are somewhat universal, and our investigations could inform the geographical imaginations of those living anywhere in the world. Now let's get back to our episode.
It's building an emotional response. It's constructing and reconstructing emotional response to climate change. I mean, it's trying to get people emotionally involved. And is that, would you argue this is just the first step then, to get people emotionally invested? And then at the same time, they're providing the science, so to speak, and communicating the science to educate people to then make decisions in their, whether that's at the household level or at the national level, in and around climate change issues. I mean, is that a long-term goal? Is there any evidence of they're pairing that kind of emotional, trying to pull people in emotionally, but are they And here I'm saying just the popular media in general, not any specific, but are they also providing the science that's allowing people to make decisions for themselves?
It's interesting that, I mean, I only looked at National Geographic and Geo, but both magazines actually provided the science first, and then they went into the emotional / showing the evidence phase.
Oh, okay.
So now we come back to the beginning of our conversation, why the Arctic is in general and the polar bears in particular are such good poster children, because you can see something or you can have images that apparently show the effects of climate change. But both with the Geo and with the National Geographic, the kind of larger narrative was to first establish the science of climate change. First say, this is climate change and this is how it works. And with the National Geographic, there were some articles that were also more skeptical and some articles saying, we don't know and there's still so much uncertainty. And then at some point they said, okay, now we have the facts and now we can really say that this is anthropogenic. And then once this kind of fact was established, the narrative could move on to this emotional phase and showing the effects and showing who is affected by climate change. Maybe it's more like, okay, maybe the facts didn't work, so we have to try the emotions now.
And partially because the there's such a polarized, it's such a polarizing issue that some people are just not even, they look at those facts, they look at the science and immediately reject it because of a whole platform of, you know, or their platform on those issues is, it's a really tricky thing for National Geographic, right? I mean, to really take a stand on climate change and try not to lose half of their readership.
Yes, And I think that's why they had to wait so long or relatively long until they could really say it, because they really had to wait until the IPCC reports were very, very clear on it, which was in, like, I think 2002 was the IPCC report, and then I think in 2004 those National Geographic articles came out. Because what you also have to consider, and that's something I learned when I visited those editorial offices, is that, of course, the story takes a very, very long time to create.
Yeah.
So sometimes years, at least half a year.
From the idea...
From the idea until it actually goes into print.
Yeah.
Because you need the pictures and you need the article to be written and everything is checked by the science department also.
So nothing goes out that hasn't been looked at by a number of eyes and people.
Yes, yes.
People who are interested, not even just the marketing of National Geographic, but the science itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So your study period is 1992 to 2012, more or less. So that's happening right in the middle. And so you're really seeing a decade leading up to that and then the decade after. And now we're 7 years past the year 2012 mark. I know you're focused in on your study period and study time period. Do you look at National Geographic? I mean, is this something you do? The 2019 narrative about polar bears, are they still coming in recent magazines?
They're still coming in National Geographic. I don't look at the magazine that regularly. When I visited the National Geographic, that was in 2016, and it was just after the deal with Fox. So then also people were a bit anxious if National Geographic's reporting on climate change would change. But actually, just in, I think, February or January of that year, they brought out one big issue on climate change to say, no, we're still going to report on that in a way. And it was very interesting that I talked to the photo editor of that magazine, and this issue in 2016 then finally only had the Earth on the cover, Spaceship Earth. But she told me, yeah, they discussed what should go on the cover. And one shot that was also that they were thinking about was an Inuit hunter standing on an ice floe. And so for me, that was really interesting to see that they're also kind of moving away and beyond the polar bears in their visual discourse, and actually ended up kind of where the environmental movement started many years ago with this just image of the Earth.
Yeah.
And that's also an icon that's used and kind of changed often in visual climate change communication, where you have the Earth and then it's kind of heating up and you have this fiery globe or globe on fire or something like that.
Right. It's interesting though, an Inuit hunter on an ice floe, that would raise whole other set of questions about, I think, maybe the National Geographic gaze historically.
Yes.
They've come out and apologized in recent years about some of their history. It certainly seems like they reading National Geographic, Lutz and Collins' book, and probably collaborated as much as you were collaborating, and they probably had a chance to peek inside the way things worked in National Geographic, I assume.
Yes.
Lutz and Collins did, yeah. So National Geographic is open to people studying them. I think that's an important transparency in some regards.
You are listening to Geographical Imaginations, where each month we venture into the geographies of everything and nothing. For more information about the show, check out the website at www.geographicalimaginations.org. Now let's get back to our episode.
Have you seen polar bears? I'm curious.
Only in the zoo.
Is there one in the Munich Zoo?
There are some in Munich Zoo, and there are some in Vienna Zoo. And they just recently renewed the whole Vienna Zoo polar bear thing, and now it's all about climate change. It's really interesting.
Really?
It's called Franz Josef's Land.
Right. Because that's next to Svalbard, Franz Josef Land, right.
It's actually really nice because the polar bears have a lot of space, and they also have places where they cannot be watched, and then you go in and you learn all about climate change and polar bears and how they're threatened. But it's well done, I think.
Huh.
Yeah, and as I have a daughter who is now 4 years old, I go to the zoo quite a lot.
Oh, well, that's great. So is that your next paper you'll do, maybe, on the Franz Josef Land exhibition in Vienna?
No.
Not enough.
I mean, I wrote a bit of a comparison between Geo and National Geographic and how they use or don't use the polar bear. And there I also talk about the Vienna Zoo a bit. But it would be interesting to look at, but I think it's not enough material for a whole paper. I think have to compare maybe Vienna and Munich Zoo on polar bears. But right now I'm focused on finishing the thesis and then doing something else maybe.
Another species or something entirely new?
Well, connected to my project, I had this idea of looking at climate change visuals, but also like how the visual is used in climate change research, and then do something also a bit Latourian. I want to follow the images. So look at how climate change visuals are produced in labs and then see where they go and where they travel and how they're taken up by other people and at conferences and by the popular media and do an ethnography of the image.
Wow.
That would be a kind of postdoc project that I would like to do.
That sounds really cool. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah. I don't know. I still need to get funding for it. So.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
Would you do like the polar bear image or something not polar bear related necessarily?
No, I think it wouldn't be so polar bear related. It would be more like, I don't know, scientific graphs and...
Oh, okay. Yeah.
How they are used and how they are created. Because, I mean, I think also within the research process, images are so important in actually kind of creating certain realities. And I want to see and watch and understand how this is done, because a lot of climate change researchers are actually meteorologists and they have these huge data sets. And how do they then create visual data out of that? And yeah.
So we've come to the end of episode 58, Poster Bear. I want to thank Dorothea Born for joining us and taking the time to walk us through some of her research and her exploration of the visual communication of climate change, especially as it pertains to the polar bear. With this episode 58, we end our two-episode series on polar bears. And in next month's episode 59, we'll speak with Dr. Lawrence Hamilton of the University of New Hampshire, who's spent the last decade or so looking at who cares about the polar regions and looking at results from surveys of U.S. public opinion and tracking public knowledge and perceptions about the Arctic. We look forward to that conversation. As always, I'd like to thank Mike Allen for permission to use his song Sand Dune, which you hear beneath my voice. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon. Bye.